Listen up, real estate investors, entrepreneurs, and agents. You're in the right place. Unlocking the secrets to real estate investing and entrepreneurship. Welcome to the Titanium Vault, hosted by RJ Bates III. Here's RJ.
Hey guys, welcome to the Titanium Vault. I'm your host, RJ Bates. Today I'm sitting down with Stephen Morse. How you doing, man?
Good, man. Really good.
Yeah, appreciate you taking the time to sit down with us today. I say that, sit down and take the time, but we all have a little bit extra time on our hands right now. Yeah. So for the people that don't know who you are, give a brief introduction of what it is that you do in real estate.
Sure. I was a college athlete and basically went to school to play a sport and get a degree. And then right after, shifted to focusing on education a little more. I went back to school. I had a business degree in undergrad, went back to school and got an MBA in finance. I had a couple cousins that had been out of school for, you know, 3-4 years that had been flipping houses. So I came out of school with that, you know, a small advantage where I could just ask people questions or, you know, walk the properties and stuff like that. And, I think my first private money loan was like $80,000 and transitioned into flipping some of my own stuff and buying some of my own stuff and that. And I'm sure we'll get into that. But when you're helping other people make money, I mean, there's a lot to learn, but you do see your checks compared to theirs. And then wonder if, you know, can I do this too, sort of a thing. And it was just that transition, helping people lease their stuff, helping people flip them their stuff, helping people buy and hold their stuff. And, you know, you talk to a lot of people in this game, it's almost like learn, implement. So wanted to get paid more, wanted to see some of the checks they were seeing. So I just figured, hey, these guys aren't that much smarter than me. So started doing it myself and ran that up to a bunch of, we were flipping a lot and we were wholesaling a lot. And we went from wholesaling to, I started a consulting company, Bulletproof Cartel. We got like 70 local investors that, you know, pay a monthly fee that we do a lot of lending to, deal flow to. That's running. Went into the apartment game, bought some apartment buildings with other people because I didn't really know what I was doing or have the capital at that point to do that. That's up to like 650 units with JV partners and then about 50 Airbnbs. And I know we were just talking about this, but with the virus, that's been on the fritz here for the last 30 days. So we're looking at a short-term pivot, but I do really like that piece and I'm not going to give it up because the returns are pretty crazy. Yep. So we're just trying to weather the storm and see what's going on right now. So that's kind of the whole story.
So I know you're based out of Cleveland, Ohio, right? Is everything that you do in Cleveland, Ohio, or is it other markets?
A lot. I know some of my JV partners are, you know, in 7 to 8 states and they pick them kind of politically as well as, you know, cap rates and ROIs and all these real estate terms as well. But we got to be like 90% Cleveland. So most stuff within like an hour, you know, we have some stuff that's like an hour and a half. I don't know why, but that just feels like I've been under contracts for 200 units, 500 units of stuff that actually didn't pan out due to due diligence in other states and stuff like that. But that 1 hour drive for whoever the property manager, it just seems to be this like weird point where you can really keep honest tabs on it.
Yep.
If you're not going to be that close, I still think it's very possible. And I would do those deals that I was talking about that didn't shake out in the past. I would do them again. I would just, I just know a little more. I'm a little more savvy now. So I would deal structure and JV partner, I guess more efficiently or take less of the deal. So I had less, cause it's just impossible. I know one of them was in Shreveport, Louisiana. And I think we were going to end up being the majority owners on it, you know, kind of young and dumb back then, just thinking I could grit it out and that probably would have blown up. So sometimes blessing in disguise that, you know, something doesn't shake out when you're just starting to get the hang of it.
So let's talk about these JV deals that you have in the multifamily side. We'll get to Airbnb later on. On the multifamily, you know, you say you're JVing with people. Are you mainly the operator or are you ever passive on some of these deals?
I'm as passive as possible. I don't know if a lot of the listeners have followed me on Instagram or Facebook, but I like to travel. I like to golf. And I have a finance background. So when I operate, like, I don't have any construction background. So it gets kind of ugly quick. So that's another thing that I would kind of tell people that I learned very, very quickly is the logistic thing. You want to, you know, you see a deal, it's a big deal. It's maybe the biggest you've ever done. You get excited. You want to do it. You're not thinking, how will this work? You're just thinking, how do I do the deal? Not how do I operate the deal? Mm-hmm. So I kind of went down some roads where I was just trying to buy big stuff that the numbers worked, but I didn't have any systems in place. And like I said, some worked out, some didn't. Luckily, some didn't, because I think it would have really rocked the boat when I didn't know what I was doing. But even locally, and I know we talked about this, but you said you had Timmy on, and he helped me buy my first apartment building ever. Well, it was the first one we bought and held. Me and him would flip some smaller stuff, 8, 12, 20-unit buildings that we didn't want to hold just due to the way the debt structured. And we bought this one, and I was sitting in his office, and you know, we know each other's operations pretty well. And, you know, I was like, I want, you know, I brought the deal. I'll sign the loan. He was signing the loan too. And then I wanted to operate at a fairly high level in the day-to-day, especially during the renovations. And, you know, he and me are very close and honest to each other. And he's like, dude, take less of the deal and don't operate. And I was like, this is my deal. I want it structured. I want it structured. And, so I tried to get more of the deal and operate day to day. And to be honest with you, it was a struggle because I'd never done apartment buildings before. One, I don't have a construction background. Two, so I think one thing I learned super quick is obviously Tim's got like 3,700 units. Listen to people that's not an accident.
Right. You know?
So listen to people that have done more than you. There's a reason they've done more than you. And then two, the joint venture stuff in apartments, there's so much like juice in the squeeze. There's so much residual every month. There's so much refi proceeds. You know, if we end up, we might sell that now that the market's a little different and the debt structure is a little different, owner finance, sell it. I know he's working on the deal there, but there's some of these deals that, you know, if you get them right, there's $1 million tax-free refis. So, you know, arguing over, are you 27% or are you 35? And really, you know, that 35 might sound great, but there's so much juice in the squeeze, like you're still going to get compensated fairly and well, and you don't have to give up your life. So I was out there, you know, a lot, going out there 2 to 3 times a week doing project management, and I wasn't even doing it well because it's not my unique ability. You know, it's kind of lying to myself saying I wanted to do it. I don't like doing it either. So that was the first one, a learning curve. Now, when I get a contract in place, a lot of times what I'll do is, you know, if I have a good, I think we were negotiating one with one of my buddies. We had 65 units in West Virginia, and I was going to pass the contract off. And he was asking me how much I wanted to make on a wholesale fee. I said, I want to stay involved in this stuff, because we were talking before the camera was rolling. It's like, we didn't want to ping on the virus the whole time, because then this interview is irrelevant. But this stuff can happen. It doesn't have to be a virus. It could be a war. It could be you know, a different
correction that we all thought was coming anyways,
but just in a different capacity.
Yeah. Right?
So, you know, I was telling him I wanted to stay involved in the deal because this, you know, residual is the key to freedom. Like that cash flow is going to come in. So I was going to take a fee. Now, when I structured the stuff, I was trying to take like a $40,000 acquisition fee on it.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to stay something in the deal for like 15% to 20% and be like completely, completely passive. I trust this guy to operate it.
Right.
And that's how I like to do the deals now, because yeah, I'm cutting my equity maybe in half-ish of what I typically would have got in the past. But, you know, West Virginia, although a cool state, I don't need to be going down there a lot or fielding calls from West Virginia when I don't have a great network down there and stuff like that. So, I give it to someone that does and can operate in that state and try to take some cash on the front end, because we were talking about this too before we started, you know, cash reserves are king. And you want to get them invested when you can. You don't want that money sitting on the sidelines. But this reminds you, like, reserves are pretty important when everyone stops making money for 14 to 21 days and they're just trying to let the dust settle.
Yeah, you know, and you bring up the equity piece there, arguing over, you know, 27 or 35%. I have been in so many larger deals or partnerships where that becomes such a toxic conversation, where it almost kills things before you even get started. And I always say, look, we're arguing over mythical money that doesn't even exist yet, you know? Yeah. And people get so wrapped up over a number.
Yeah.
You know, and like you said, your unique ability was not in the operating side of things. Mm-hmm. And so what was the kind of, when did you decide to have that mind shift where it's like, hey, it's better to take less and partner with someone like Tim Brotts? What caused that?
I think that's a huge takeaway that you just said, that if people are obviously watching and listening, they should write down. It's like, I will not, and it's crazy. People are like, well, how do I know I'm going to get fairly compensated?
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm pretty, you know, I know I'm pretty honest. And, you know, you don't get to 700 units, 80% of them being joint ventures by screwing people over. Like, you just wouldn't get the deal flow brought to you. You get a bad reputation and people wouldn't bring you stuff. So I tell people that, but also, and I don't mean this disrespectfully because I was in the same boat a while back, is like, I would find 50 unit buildings, 100 unit buildings, and I would take them. Now, granted, he's a friend and I trust him, and like, you know, I'll go over to his house and vice versa. We go to Indians, get a little different, but I would take him a deal, and not necessarily the first thing we would talk about is the equity split. It was more like, does this deal work for us?
Yep.
You know, and we're not arguing. It's not like I have a deal locally that looks good, but I need 35%. Cause he's like, I don't even know what 35% is. Even worse off, that 35% on the deal that we were just talking about, it's kind of up the street. It was 30, you know, if you start arguing about these numbers, you're right, they're mythical. Like, now we're done with the project in the middle of like an economic crisis. So now we're probably going to pivot and we're still going to make a bunch of money, but there's different ways to make money and there's going to be different outcomes and different numbers. Like, arguing about numbers 18 months in advance, like you said, I don't even know if I do deals with people like that. You know, they'll send me emails and be like, you know, sign this, and it's, you know, this crazy non-disclosure, and we're not giving you any details until you sign it and we come to terms. I'm like, how would this work? You know, and not only how would it work, but how would it work after we come to terms? Because it's almost like I don't want to do business with people,
right?
You know, it's just so abrasive.
Well, it's immaturity is what it is. It shows how that relationship could possibly be down the road, where it's like, dude, if we can't come to an agreement on something like this where we're just analyzing a deal, if that's the most important part, we don't even know if this is a deal or not, you know? It's crazy to have that conversation that early on. And I'll share a quick story about that. So I went to Tim Brotts, one of his first trainings that he ever had. This is back before the commercial empire was like a thing. It was just at the Brotts Manor. And I went with one of my local buddies, Austin Good.
Yeah.
When we came back, I listened to exactly what Tim did. You know, he said, you know, blast out this email to your buyers list and see who's willing to sell some commercial units.
Right.
And we got several storage unit deals sent my way.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately sent it to Austin and said, hey, let's analyze this, because Austin would be my Tim Brotts in this scenario,
sure,
right? Yeah. Like, Austin, someone who's in the commercial space, he has experience. I would want a JV with him so I could just watch. We never once had the conversation about equity all the way up until it was time to make our offer. And he said, hey, look, if we're going to do this, I'm willing to give you 20%.
Uh-huh.
I said, awesome. And he goes, you don't want to know anything more about that? Nope.
Yeah.
It's my deal, but I'm willing to give up 80% of it because, hey, if I kept 100% of this, I'm just going to go lose a bunch of people's money and I'm going to waste my time. I don't know how to do this.
You give yourself headaches, man. Yeah. I think that one thing that people don't realize too is, like, you know, that, you know, more money, more problems, like more equity, more headaches. Like, you got to answer the phone. You got to talk about these tenants that, like, you know, I get these emails on some of the stuff I am majority owner on.
Mm-hmm.
Smaller buildings, like 24 units, you know, some of these buildings that, like, I'm majority 70 units on, and property management, they email you. I don't care what system you have in place, what, you know, hierarchy, and you're somehow you end up on these things CC'd or someone can't make a decision. Then you get a call and it's like, awesome. You know, you're going to have to once in a while take down the deal and be the guy, but you can make some pretty cool businesses or a lot of your portfolio off of deal finding, deal structuring, networking. And, you know, those checks, they hit a little different when you haven't seen. So, like, for example, that one that I was very involved in, weekly calls, and I'm okay doing that. Like, I'm not scared of work, but weekly calls, early on in the project, 2 to 3 times a week, me or my team going out there, you know, whole list of problems with the building. Now, we bought it so well, it's still going to make a bunch of money. We fixed it, so if we have to hold it or we choose to hold it, these are, you know, brand new roofs, brand new sewer pipes, brand new plumbing. So, like, you're thinking maybe now it's headache-free, which is great. So there's positives and negatives, but that check when it comes in will be a little different than the 70 units I got with Josh Steinberger. He's got a construction company.
Mm-hmm.
I'm awful at construction. You know, he's got this huge construction company. We got a guy in place that does the property management that we inherited from the purchase. I went down there and walked the building like two or three times and got 27.5% of the deal. And, you know, that's, I think, 30 days out from refining. And before they switched up that commercial lending requirements and some of the Fannie and Freddie, you know, we were going to refi out and chop up like 600 grand tax free on this refi. I've got 6 hours into the project. Like, I was down there twice. Like, that hits a little different than a year of project management or property management or whatever that looks like. And, you know, it's got to be, you know, hourly, one of the best deals I'll ever do. I went down there for the inspection. I went down there for the walkthrough, and I get maybe one or two text messages a month. I log into the bank account. You know, again, one of my good friends, trust and verify, log into the bank account, look at 3-4 things, look at a report, it's over with. You know, I probably, like I said, have like 6 real hours over a year into the project, and it's going to cash out. Plus, it's 70 units for the rest of your life, you know? So it's a pretty cool.
Isn't that what we all talk about anyways? Is that's what we're trying to create? Not, hey, I want to own 100% and work these thousands and thousands of hours to own all of this, right? That's the message that we all try to get across in freedom of time and creating financial freedom.
Yeah.
Getting to that point where it's like, dude, we're refinancing, we're chopping up $600,000 on something that I've got 6 hours in. That's the dream, right? Mm-hmm. And so for the people that are listening, they're like, okay, hey, that sounds amazing, but right now I'm a wholesaler or I'm a flipper and I'm doing everything myself. What are some of the things that they can do to kind of break into this and find a way to leverage whatever skill set they have to get into the commercial space?
Yeah. And you know what's crazy? I don't think we could have planned that transition better, because the deal actually has someone in the deal that had never done a rental property before.
Nice.
So that's like, this is a great example. And that's another person that I know I'm kind of coming off as I usually don't talk about who I won't do deals with, but it's a good point. I get these people where they find me at a happy hour, or they see me out at a Indians game or whatever, and they follow some stuff online, and they'll ask, you know, how you get started or what deal are you working on? And I'll just tell them either one, how I got started, which is just simply, I bought a duplex and it works, so I bought more. And then when you buy something that works, you try to make it bigger.
Yep.
So that's, you know, and then the other question is, what deal are you working on now? And I'll tell them, and they kind of see them glaze over, like, well, I don't know how I'd do 70 units, or I don't know how I'd do, you know, how would I raise $1 million to pull down a $4 million apartment building? And I used to have a lot of those thoughts, but it's scary to do business with people that are like, sounds good, but sounds too good to be true. Like, those are dangerous people. And I get that a lot. Or if I tell people about Tim, like, oh, my buddy's 34 and he has 4,000 units. They're like, no. I'm like, well, yeah, he works next door to me every day, you know, like, right. I've seen his balance sheet and all this stuff. But so that's a dangerous person. But I think I have real life examples. That's what I like about my consulting group, is when I, you know, either pitch that or people ask about it, I don't ever hard sell it. But there's some people in there that are very relatable, like God bless Tim and DM and some of these guys. But like, you tell success stories about them, or, you know, Mark Evans' email company, and people kind of like get intimidated or feel fishy, like, okay, so he's making money off, you know, selling data and all this stuff. So I got some guys in the consulting group, the Bulletproof stuff, that, you know, a year ago had zero rental properties. They had a family house where their family was living, and he was an agent and reached out to me and said, you know, I want to kind of start getting involved in what, you know, some of the other guys in this market, he's from Cleveland, are doing as well. How do I get started? We point him in like 3-4 directions. So he's one of those guys. It's Dan Mitchin, if anyone knows who he is, that's following. But he's one of those guys, like, if you tell him to do it, like, he doesn't go read a book to clarify how to do it or come back and ask 5 different new questions on how to do it. It's like, you get off the phone and this kid is doing whatever you told him to do. Don't care if it's like jumping jacks. He's doing them right off the phone call. So I told him three or four things I thought he could do. He didn't own one investment property. He started calling for rents and offering not to rent them, but say, hey, we'd love to buy the building. And obviously that sounds crazy simplistic to some people, like that wouldn't work, too good to be true, right? They're already saying they want to rent, not that they want to sell.
Right.
And that guy was a little older. He's like, yeah, I'd consider it. Dan throws out an offer. Again, he's a real estate agent that owns zero rental properties, and he's offering to buy like a $4 million apartment. You know, like, I don't know if I would have done that, but he went and did it. So, you know, shoots me an email, and he's like, they accepted. I'm like, accepted what? Like, I was not on. He didn't show me the address or Google Earth it. And he's like, this 70-unit apartment building. I'm like, oh, let's go look at it, you know? So we got down there, and he walked a 70-unit apartment building. And he is the smallest owner in the operating agreement, but he put up zero capital, made a phone call. And then he's probably got about the same hours I got into it. He's just not on the loan. He didn't secure the loan like I did, so he's got smaller equity than I do. But again, 600 grand and 70 units chopped up for a kid that basically wasn't scared to try, you know, or just to sit in a corner and say, that sounds too good to be true. So this kid went from 0 units to 70 overnight. And now me and him own 125 units together in the first year of him, you know, partnering with me and being in that consulting group. And, you know, multiple Airbnbs, two or three apartment buildings, one where he, you know, he was like very minority ownership on the first one, obviously proves that he's willing to work and add value, bring us really good deals. The next one, I think he jumped up to like 30-35%.
Nice.
So, you know, that's the kind of progression that you want to see if you're doing business with the right people. Add value, they give you more equity. Add value, they give you, you know, more freedom, stuff like that. So those are cool stories where, or if someone's just listening, like, it's not impossible. I mean, I remember I got another story where I was in East Cleveland and I was trying to buy houses that I probably could have got when I was real young and broke and dumb. I was trying to buy houses where I could have got shot in the front yard, or, you know, they would have just been headaches for 3 years coming after them. I told this story on a different podcast, but the guy wanted 11 grand for like a turnkey duplex that was fully rented at like $600 or $700 a side. I was so broke and so scared to actually do deals. I think I tried to negotiate him down to $7,000 in the front yard, and he's like, no. And he was telling me a story like, this is the last one I got to sell out of off my 60 doors. And I remember thinking when I was like 24 years old, and I think I probably had like 6 doors, you know, but it felt like a lot at the time. And I'm standing in the front yard, and all I could think about is, like, I could get the 60 doors. Like, I'd be rich forever. I'd be a huge investor, like, all this shit. And then you get around the right people. You're watching your buddy get 4,000 doors.
Right.
Now, 60 doesn't seem like that much. Or you watch your buddy come into a consulting group that you run, and he gets 125 in a year. I don't even know how long that took me. Probably 5 years to get over 100, you know? Right. And then it exploded. But watching people do that, I think, is really powerful. Those are the stories where people can see it and say, all right, he had zero, he went to 100. I could do that. It's hard for people to see. He went, you know, a year or a decade ago, he had zero. Then he went to 300. Then he went back to zero. Then he scaled it again. Then he went up to 4,000. That's kind of like Tim's story.
Right.
That's overwhelming. It's a decade. They can't wrap their hands around it. They can't figure out how they would get their first 1,000. So I like to tell those stories where it's like someone had a job and replaced their income, or someone had zero properties and they got to 100. Or, you know, there's people that in our group that have done really cool wholesaling, you know, months where they're a firefighter, still are a firefighter, and they did over 200 grand in wholesale fees in 30 days.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And look, I know we've referenced a couple of people, and they've been previous guests on the podcast. So if you're interested, go back. Yeah. Tim Brotz was an interview, incredible story. He shares how, you know, he basically bought his first property using credit cards.
Yeah, that's a wild story.
Yeah, just awesome. And then Mark Evans DM, for anyone that's ever listened to Mark talk about anything, he's an incredible mind. One of the most difficult interviews I've ever had to do in my life. This guy is so damn smart. I'm like, I don't know what questions that I can even ask this man. But it both incredible interviews. And I appreciate you bringing them up because, hey, they're people that helped you get to where you are today, right? They're your buddies. They're your mentors. And then I think that's important to latch on to people like that. And you've opened up that opportunity for people with, you know, the Bulletproof Cartel and allowing that to create this guy who never owned anything, and now he owns 120 doors. I mean, that's awesome. And look, to your point, it's not about how he went and did it by himself. Right. It was he found a way to add value to you, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you reciprocated that back to him. And now he's in multifamily and Airbnbs and all these different things with you. And that opportunity is just going to continue to grow for him. So let's transition a little bit from the multifamily, because I know we also want to talk about what you're doing in Airbnb. So how did those two things correlate together? You know, how are you going out and saying, hey, I'm going to buy this 100-door, multifamily, and then say, okay, now I'm going to transition to, I want to buy this one house that's a vacation rental. How did those two things correlate?
Yeah, so it's funny, actually. I just turned 31, so I feel like I have somewhat of a, finger on kind of what the young group and young people are spending their money on, or how they value the world, right? Like, a lot of times there was this American dream: you get the house, you get the, wife and the car and the dog, and it seems like my generation, or definitely underneath my generation, seemed to value that travel piece and that lifestyle piece a little differently than my parents did or their generation did. So, just obviously trying to stay current with what the world is or wants to do. That was definitely something, but I won't act like, again, we were talking about this before we got on, the way the market swings and trends swing, I don't think anyone's a real prophet. So it was funny. I was actually at a mastermind. It was Tim's mastermind 2 years ago. And, this is another thing people don't talk about, honestly, with multifamily is like the first year kind of sucks, because these are huge projects that take your whole time. Like I said, I was going out to the project 2-3 times a week, or I was trying to find new deal flow, or if you're going to raise the money for it, like, it can take weeks, a lot of conversations to raise the money and paperwork, because you might be raising $500,000, $1 million, $2 million. Mm-hmm. So these are like time consuming things that for 12 to 18 months might actually not pay you anything unless you're flipping it quickly. That's why we did flip some of the smaller ones. There was actual, payouts in those. These big properties, you can't, you can legally refi them in sooner than 12 months. But a lot of times you need that 12 months to take out excess loan proceeds. They'll just let you do the cash basis. So I'm sitting in a mastermind I forget at the time, it was 2 years ago. So I had multiple hundreds of units, and a lot of them weren't either cash flowing, or we were using the cash flow to continue the renovations on the projects because they're so large. So, I'm sitting around, and you go around a lot of those masterminds, people ask you what your biggest hurdle is, what your biggest opportunity is. And I remember thinking, and I don't usually, mix my words too much. They got to me and I was like, it's going to be awkward to say out loud, but like, for what you see on my PFS, like the personal financial statement, net worth, all that stuff, cool. They get to me, they're like, what's your biggest hurdle? I'm like, I'm broke, Yep. Like, I don't care what this net worth number is or what you guys hear, how many units I got. Like, I'm cash broke because all my stuff is 12-month projects, 18-month projects, and it's going to pay out. Some of them were projecting $1 million, $600,000. We already talked about some of that stuff. That's cool, but it's you got to get to the finish line, right? Like, you can't just – this is, a pie in the sky for 12, 18 months. So it was a lot of trying to follow the trends, but also, like, dude, if you're broke, you'll do some stuff that makes a lot of sense in short-term capital. So these, instead of refining out in 18 months, a lot of these have kicked off 30, 40 grand that was tax-free, the Airbnb side, in 3 or 4 months. So now you got these refis that are hitting basically every month because we're doing more than one. Which is just like a nice chunk to keep the lights on and pay my employees and stuff like that. But more importantly, once you get them up and running, you got a house that would probably rent for $1,200, $1,300, renting for like $3,500 a month because you're getting daily rents of like $150 a night and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And Airbnb pays you every four days after someone checks out. So it's not the first of the month, or it's not every 18 months on a commercial refi. It's like constant cash flow.
Yep.
You sit in a room with a bunch of guys, and like you said, there's some smart, wealthy people in the room. Like, I didn't want to be like, yo, I'm broke. I don't care if it's cash broke or not. Like, I got a lot of pride. And I said it, and a couple people that obviously know my lifestyle, hang out with me multiple weeks, like, bullshit, you're broke. I'm like, dude, I'm telling you, like, I have plenty of assets. I need cash flow. So it was like this weird watching the trends, noticing that young people like to stay in Airbnbs and hotels, and then, you know, a little bit of a survival thing, right? Like if you can't get cash flow off your other side of your business for a year, then what can you yin and yang with that? So you've got constant, you know, little wires or distribute, you know, they distribute your rent 4 days after the person checks out, which I thought that was a good pairing. And I don't think I ever sat down and thought about it. It was like, do I want to pay my bills next month? And how am I going to do that? You know, so.
I appreciate you saying that though, because I used to say the phrase, I'm the most broke rich man in the world.
Yeah, like,
you know, I fill out these personal financial statements. Yeah. I send them to banks and it's like, oh man, yeah, it looks amazing.
But yeah.
At the end of the day, you know, when it comes time to look at my own personal bank account and things like that, it's like, you know, I don't feel like I'm living the life of what that personal financial statement says. And look, sometimes it's not sexy to say those things on a podcast, right?
Oh, no, I get that. I wish someone would have told me that before. You know, like I said, it's funny. You know, you can't fake 4,000 units. You can't fake being in business for 30, 40 years. And I remember walking out of the gym when we had just inked that first deal. And we, you know, like I said, you get all the projections. If you do the right analysis, you know what you're going to make in 12 to 18 months, at least close. Now you got like, I don't even know what I was, 27, 28 year old kid walking out the gym with these projections 12 months out, telling my dad about the deal I was doing. And he's like, don't give up, you know, the wholesaling piece. And in my head, I was like, F that, you know, like I'm going to give it up. I'm going to own 20,000 units. I'm going to be rich. And, you know, obviously he knew something I didn't, being in business and working for huge companies over, like, cash flow is massively important.
Yep.
Just like projected, you know, dividends or stuff like that down the road, like cash flow gets you to that finish line where you can cash that big check. So it's got to be a yin and yang thing. Another script that I don't know which one of my mentors say it. I think it's Lee Carney says, so many people go broke making a lot of money, you know?
Yep.
Like they're making money 2 years out, but there's no money to keep the employees there to get to that project or that payday or, you know, that refi or that, you know, business sale, whatever industry, whatever exit strategy they have, you got to get there, right? It can't just be on paper.
A reason why people say you need multiple streams of revenue, you know? Yeah. I mean, and this is the reason why. I mean, you're sitting here and you're talking about when you're breaking in 12 to 18 months, you're not seeing basically any cash flow, any money at all.
A lot of them have sunk expenses, right? So like, again, on paper, you borrow X from the bank to buy it. You raise the down payment. You buy borrow the cap expenses. And then, I mean, you are buying value add buildings a lot of times, especially in the market that we're in. So they're mismanaged. They're, you know, I'm not saying the owners hid stuff from us, but you start opening some walls and these owners aren't selling pristine buildings.
Right.
Sell. You know, you start opening walls that haven't been opened in 30, 40 years. And what you borrowed isn't enough to fix the problems maybe that you found. You know, it doesn't always sound like a ton, but like on this 24 unit building, I got like 40 grand of my own money. I think my partner has 100 G's of his money in it. We were out of pocket 30, 40, 50 grand on a 30 unit building the other day. We actually were able to restructure that and pull it out. And I got a buddy that's, I think, like 50 grand out of, he's the minority owner, 50 grand out of pocket on an 8 unit Airbnb building. Like awesome, awesome building when it's going to be all said and done. But, you know, you start pushing that money out and, you're not only not getting paid, but you start to add it all up and you got, you know, multiple six figures out in your projects or other people do, and it can get hairy. So I think you have to lead with revenue. I think real business owners back into their solutions by their problem. You know? So I was on a private coaching call with Advisors Council, which Tim and Lee kind of run, and a lot of other people are involved in running it. But you know, I was telling them my current problems are very similar to my problems 12 months ago. It's like, we got all these bills and really good overhead because you need that in the market that we were just in. And now the market switches. And it's like, how do you keep paying your overhead? Because you don't want to just blow up a business that was working. So right. How do you keep your overhead while you create new revenue or different revenue? Because some things that were working aren't working. And Tim was, you know, he oversimplified it. He's like, just back into it. Like, if you need more cash flow, like, how would you get more cash flow today? And I usually say things less polished than a lot of those speakers, but my script for that is like, if you put a gun in my head and I got to make 10 grand today, how am I doing it? And I think that's really powerful, you know?
Well, it is. It is. And I love that, you know, going back to what you just said, you know, that sometimes problems make us create solutions, right? And what's funny about that is as entrepreneurs and business owners, we should be thinking about those problems before they just come out of nowhere and slap us in the face, right? But nobody could have predicted what we're currently going through with the coronavirus, right? So what has kind of been that impact on both the multifamily and the Airbnb side of things for you? How's that impact?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to talk the technical piece, is that Freddie and Fannie, they're basically requiring anywhere from 6 to 18 months of interest reserves on, you know, a lot of the loans, be it storage, apartments, you know, probably warehouse space, any of that stuff. It seems like they're requiring 6 to 18 months of, depending on what market and what kind of asset you have, their payments to themselves, basically, which one makes me feel iffy, right? Like when very smart people in banks are saying, hey, we don't even know if the big guys are going to pay us.
Right.
You know, it made me at least kind of take a step back and evaluate the market. But so when we go to refi that building, it's 70 units and we're supposed to get, you know, $500,000-$600,000 out. They're going to hold 150, 200 grand of that for themselves. So if we mismanage our money or our building, that they can pay themselves for 12 months to either come out of a bottom of a market and be able to exit, or just to not bleed 12 months when they're not getting paid. So that is a unique difference that you got to be underwriting. If you're getting into like new deals, you got to be underwriting, assuming that that's going to be around even when your project's done, or
right.
You're taking it on the front end of the construction loans too. So a lot of those construction value add loans are 2, 3, 4, 5 years with a balloon. And, you know, they're taking that same interest reserve on those as well. So now with the refis, they take it for a year. And obviously, if you're a good operator or you have a good operator or joint venture partners, you're paying your bill the whole time. A year, they snap it right back off. So it's almost like a two-tier refi.
Yep.
So you just got to be aware of what changed. As far as
Airbnb, it's actually not too terrible of a bad thing, because if you think about it, you – like you said, if you're a good operator and you're going to pay your bills in 12 months, you're going to get another pop.
Another pop. And again, if you follow me on Instagram or Facebook or Snapchat or whatever, like, you give me a bunch of money that I don't need, like, I'll find a way to lose it. So I think it's like a two-tier. It's like a safety net for people. So no, but usually I'm pretty good at getting my money back working. I just like with the travel and stuff. It's like, I always tell my mom, like, I like having my bank account. I think it got cut in half over the last 21 days, like my operations account, because we paid all our bills and like we don't have the Airbnb coming in, and we are pivoting, but you know, it doesn't happen overnight. You gotta, you know, some people aren't working, so now you're down man hours.
Right.
So you know,
what are some of the pivots that you're making with Airbnb?
Yeah, so Airbnb just gets its teeth kicked in that no one can handle, and or they don't trust that they're getting cleaned properly and all this kind of stuff. So you know, I read a couple things that if you're going to continue to operate as Airbnb, you know, units throughout this little virus or crisis or whatever, that you want to change just some of the wording, like secluded, cleaned, professionally cleaned, like some stuff that we used to not, you know, it was almost like so unsexy that I would never put it in like the search bar, you know. You know, the words that mattered before this are like walkable to, West 25th, or like that's a popular street.
Right.
Walkable to West 6th, like these places where people know, like maybe the Brown Stadium's there, all the bars are there. I want to be able to walk there. Downtown views, all this stuff that used to be cool and sexy. Now it's like, you know, sparkling clean, disinfected, like all this shit. Like, it's like marketing 101, but the other side of it.
Right.
So that was
not close to anybody.
Yeah. You will have no neighbors, no fun. You'll be safe. But it was that was a little change. I don't even think we did that much of that, because I don't think that – I think this is going to get – and I don't want to go down this weird virus ramp, but this is going to get a little worse before it gets a lot better.
Right.
And I think what we're doing with the pivot is, which makes more sense, instead of just like bleeding this, you know, we are still getting Airbnb requests and stuff, but it's like, you know, we're going from 20 out of the 30 nights being booked to 6, you know, it's a real hit. Right. So, you know, we just reached out to some hospitals and stuff like that. We buy a lot around the hospitals because they're huge in Cleveland, buy a lot around the stadiums and the bars, which those are obviously taking big, big hits. You know, trying to get traveling nurses into the 1 to 3 month leases when they're going to be helping out at the big hospitals, or businessmen, or here's another thing, people that are exposed to this stuff, essential workers, that if they have some disposable income, you know, if there's like a dad that's working in a hospital and he's a doctor, a lot of times they don't want to go home to their kids. And that's a sad world that we live in. If they're going to grab a Airbnb for 2 months right around the clinic and be very due diligent on when and how they see their kids so they don't get sick, or they don't get them sick if they're coming in and out of essential or high risk areas. We've been reaching out to people and just trying to fulfill that need. And what we're trying to do there, because all our houses are furnished and whatnot, is, you know, whatever market rent is, we use rentometer.com to kind of try to find that out really quickly. You know, if it's, give me a round number, $1,000 a month for a little 3-bedroom unfurnished, and we got a 3-bedroom over there furnished, we usually charge like $1,500. We're trying to get like 1.5x. We'll get that for 3 months. And then I think the cool thing is we are very, very aware of being able to go back there. So I was on a live or a podcast, and someone asked, I think it was live because there's live questions coming in. It's like, have you considered, you know, whatever, you know, Section 8 or going back to 1-2 year leases, stuff like that? Right. Absolutely not, because the returns are so good in Airbnb that I want that ability to pop right back in. Not only because the returns are good when normal travel's happening, but I think people are going to blow money when this thing is done. I think like sanity's taking a hit. Right. And like, you know, Wanderlust, that's like huge for me. So I, the day they lift this travel ban, I don't know if I'll be back in Ohio for 90 days. So I'm hoping that everyone else feels the same way. And I want those like 1, 2, 3 month leases to have a lot of flexibility. So when one gets the green light to go travel and have fun and spend money again, that we're at the forefront of, you know, as hard as we probably got hit that the 2-3 months that people didn't travel, I think those 2-3 months right after are going to see like almost no vacancy. So I want the flexibility there to take advantage of something.
Yeah. You know, it's weird because everybody talks about how this is going to hit our economy and are we headed for a recession and things like that. But it's like, think about how many people are in unemployment right now, right? Well, when the lights get turned back on, these companies are going to have to hire people back
fast.
Yeah, exactly.
And we were talking about before the camera started recording, we were just talking about like very similar numbers to the 08, but a different reason it happened.
Yes.
Different speed that it happened. So the speed that it happened at, like you said, I think these companies are going to have to rebound just as fast, because it's not like, you know, we're in the same kind of actual economic restraints that we were in 08. Like, there's going to be a lot of people that do have money that want to get out of the house and start spending quick, you know? So,
I'm looking at everything. I mean, I'm talking about, I mean, take it to like something that you and I both enjoy. We both love sports, right? I mean, how are the NBA and NHL going to respond to this? And Major League Baseball, I mean, right? I mean, when they turn the lights back on, it's going to be just, hey, rapid fire. We got to get these seasons over with. Redo the schedules. The arenas are going to be open. I mean, if this all turns out to be, you know, something that can be contained and we go back to normal life, but travel is going to pick right back up, I think.
And I think sporting events, like those ticket prices are going to be 3x. Like, mm-hmm. I've been scrolling, you know, my gallery on my iPhone of like all these games I went to and planes I was on and
right, you know,
cool areas I saw. And I'm just sitting in the house, like, I can't wait. And I'm hoping, you know, for a lot of reasons, economic boost, morale. You know, I just think that like people are, you know, at the finest stage kind of animalistic, and you put people mm-hmm. in four walls too long, I think it messes with a lot more than the economy. So I'm excited to take advantage of that in the Airbnb field, but also enjoy, you know, being a little more reflective on my own personal life. Like, I was doing some things that, especially in my late 20s and now my early 30s, that a lot of people don't get to do, and kind of being a an asshole about it because, you know, that was life to me. And now I kind of realize that, you know, you can be a little more respectful of not only having the opportunity to do it, but like putting yourself in a position to continue to do that. Like, you felt like at this market with two or three good business models, like, how would I ever get hurt? You know,
we all felt like Superman, right?
Yeah. I mean, a rising tide floats all boats, and
right.
There's some things now that I realize that I can still do financially, but no one will let me do it logistically. But if I don't continue to do the right logistical stuff in my business, there might be a time and day that I'm not able to travel, that I'm not able to pay, you know, for my parents to fly somewhere to see me when I'm speaking, mm-hmm. whatever that looks like. And
look, you and I both are big on having mentors and being a part of masterminds. You've talked about multiple masterminds that you've either attended or you're a part of. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions I've always asked was, okay, you survived 08. What do you think is going to happen in the time being? Well, here's the reality. Every single person I talked to was wrong. Okay, yeah. No one sat there and predicted there was going to be a worldwide pandemic that quarantined us all and shut us down. All right, no one predicted that, but it's what happened. And so now here we are in this unknown time. No one was, it maybe people were prepared for some kind of correction or slowdown or whatever, but no one was prepared for this. And at this point in time, yeah, I think, look, we're both younger guys. I'm getting a little bit less younger as every day that goes by. But, you know, you sit there and you're grateful for the opportunities that we've had to be able to do this, that we're going to be able to come out the other side of this better for it.
Yeah.
And I think everybody agrees that when we do come out the other side of this, that our economy is going to rise very quickly from this.
Yeah, I think it will. And I think that's just good for everyone. You know, mm-hmm. I was there's a brewery right up the street. I go up there 2-3 times a week when it's open, and they're still doing takeout, and grab some food and like this big growler of beer and try to give the guy the biggest tip I could. And like, just because, like, as much as like, you know, my business is getting hit, like, you're watching a bartender fill up a growler for you with no one else in the bar. It's like this
right.
weird zombie movie where it's like an apocalypse, just you and the bartender, they're the only two people left. I give him, you know, as much as I could. And he looked at me and obviously was completely grateful, but you just feel grateful that, you know, my industry is not booming, but it's not shut down.
Right.
And, I have the ability to create my own jobs and my own paychecks, which, you know, that guy's at the mercy of the government right now. Or
absolutely.
The CDC, and I understand they're doing what they think is right, but like, man, it's tough to see other people struggle like that. So
look, at the end of the day, I've been able to sell properties in like five different states since this started. I mean,
yeah, we're blessed to be able to operate still. You know, there's a lot
at that, full price. I mean, yeah. It's not even like I'm selling them on discounts. So not really a whole lot has changed in that regard for our companies yet. And I see a lot of people kind of hitting the panic button, and I'm right there with you, man. I'm grateful that we're able to do what we're doing because, like you said, man, there's people out there that are just at the mercy of this. There's nothing that they can do to support their families or themselves.
I know we're probably somewhat close to wrapping up, but yep. I think a couple things is like the residual is, you know, you're guilty of this sometimes. Like, you know, I always say like businesses are kind of like a plant. Sometimes it's overwatered, sometimes it's underwatered, sometimes it's got to be moved into the sun. And, you know, I love the residual side and the lifestyle freedom side, but, you know, I definitely, either for good or bad reasons, I need the cash because, you know, my plant needs some water, or I'm just greedy and want to go on a vacation and spend, you know, I'll take that wholesale check or whatever that looks like. And, you know, that residual piece is what I think gets people in and out of this stuff. And also, speaking on another big reason to do real estate or become your own boss or invest in yourself is like, even if they shut down real estate, like, you can't be out showing, selling houses.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to process title and or, you know, deeds or whatever that looks like, which they never would. So that's right. A good thing. But two, if they did, you know, I could virtual wholesale, or I could get involved in some deal flow, or I could work some, you know, I could scale my consulting piece, you know? So I feel blessed that, you know, and I feel very bad and try to do as much as I can for the local, you know, economy. Is like, I don't wear that many hats, but my hair looks like shit because no one can cut hair. Or, you know, I try to tip well when I'm out, but I'm trying to tip better when I'm out grabbing food now because they've been told they can't work. And I think that'll make you, you know, these guys that are entrepreneurs or investors or whatever, that's hopefully making people go harder when it opens up again, because like you want to be in a position where no one can shut you down. No one can, even if they do shut you down, that your residual is so strong that it doesn't affect you like maybe it affects other people. And again, you know, with how great everything was, I think sometimes you take advantage of like, you know, you're kind of setting your own hours and your own paychecks and stuff like that. I think it's made me more grateful, you know, that when this goes back to normal, that I need to structure some stuff and, you know, basically just not take it for granted as much too. So definitely reflectful, you know, it's cool.
Do you know how busy barbershops are going to be when this is all over with?
Yeah, I'm thinking about, I've had the same haircut, same style for like 3-4 years. A lot longer, and I'm thinking like by the time this is done, I might have to switch it up. It's gonna be so long that it might be a good time to transition. Like I got different options now, but I've had hats on for like 5-6 days, so it's I'm not even a hat guy.
So. Oh man, I'm pretty bald, and my kid came up to me yesterday, and he goes, "Dad, are you trying to grow hair?" I'm like, "No, it's just there's nothing I can do about it, man."
It's a different, I actually was going to try to get my barber to come my hairdresser to come over, and she's like, "I don't want to get sick." I was like, "Dude, I'll take a temperature. You can cut me in my own house.
We'll
do it outside. I don't care. Like just, I need something done right now." But it's a different world. I think a lot of the high level guys, you know, and now I'm kind of going back to something 30 minutes ago, but you talked about Mark Evans being a crazy hard interview. I could see that. Mm-hmm. And there's people have unique abilities. Like Tim is so locked into multifamily. He won't do single family. He's laser focused. I love having him as a mentor because that shows you how powerful that is.
Right.
Mark, to me, is like, not that he's not laser focused, but he's so knowledgeable on so much shit that when I bring him a problem or I sit down with him or we just like one-on-one, is like, he's talking to you about, this is your model. How do you scale it and then sell it as a business? Like he doesn't see real estate as a business. He sees it almost kind of like a headache. I know he makes a lot of money on it, but he likes to get in those fields that you can like package this up and sell it.
Yep.
So I just think that's kind of powerful. And this like whole thing has made me really conscious of like what I need to do when everything kicks back up. What are real exit strategies? Am I producing things that I could sell at like a 4, 5, 5x, 10x, like his email marketing business, or am I creating things that maybe are just headaches that get you some cash flow? Like I think it puts it in retrospect of like, what are we doing when we get out of this? So if anything else ever happens, virus, not war, whatever, why am I in a better spot next time than I was when this started, you know?
Absolutely, man. Well, on that note, I think there's no better time for us to wrap this up. I appreciate you so much for taking the time. And, you know, I know you're putting out content more regularly and trying to, you know, as best you possibly can get people, you know, educated in this. And, you know, it is weird times. I'm happy that, you know, you're going to be able to come out better on the other side of this. So I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah,
guys, if you're listening on iTunes, make sure you give us a 5-star review. If you want to give us less stars than 5, give them to somebody else. We only accept 5-star reviews. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure you give us a thumbs up and hit the subscribe button. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Thanks so much for listening to The Titanium Vault with your host, RJ Bates III. For more info and to stay up to date, visit www.podcast.thetitaniumvault.com and on facebook.com/thetitaniumvault. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate and review, and we'll catch you next time on The Titanium Vault.